Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Apologies for the delay in getting this podcast up. Some weather-related issues forcing me to change travel plans around, that type of thing. A lot of snow throughout the Midwest where I was traveling this week, but back in Colorado Springs here, Leighton, of course, in the LA area, and we're ready to go with four fresh retail stories this week. We'll talk Amazon and Whole Foods to start the show. We'll also talk JCPenney, Lowe's also producing their earnings call, and we'll talk about one up-and-coming retailer in the Dallas area that might have more money flowing its way. All of that to come here on the Retail Focus Podcast. A quick reminder to like us and rate us however you do access us, whether that's Podbean, whether that's Spotify, whether that's Apple Podcasts, any of those methods, certainly your ratings help out. Also, check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. So we begin with two short stories in one. Amazon is looking to open a concept different than Whole Foods in the grocery space, this after they announced that they were rebranding their 365 stores. And then Gap, meanwhile, is looking to spin off the Old Navy brand. First, we'll talk about Amazon. Now, Amazon, as we know, has done quite a bit to Whole Foods since acquiring the once publicly traded grocery chain. Much of what they've done, however, has not spurred on higher sales. It's been done with cost cutting in mind and also trying to spur on traffic, which we haven't seen. Whole Foods, still extremely popular, but arguably doesn't compete well against less costly conventional grocery stores. Think the likes of Walmart and Kroger and Amazon. In order to combat this somewhat, they're trying a new model out when it comes to Whole Foods.
Yeah, there's a lot of details that we have yet to really see and that are yet to be disclosed by Amazon employees. And I think this is going to be an interesting move for Amazon. And I think there's a lot of reasons why they might go into this space. One reason is that many people are slow to be adopting the only Whole Foods model and that they're less interested in just buying all organic items and are still going to Kroger, Walmart, and say Target for some of their conventional items. You think of offerings in their homes such as cereal, sweets, frozen foods for the family. I think that's an important distinction between what Amazon has in Whole Foods versus this new model. And a lot of the details are a little murky, but for good reason. A lot of the times, if Amazon waits to produce all of the details, you can create some sort of a media buzz a little bit bigger than you would see in a typical grand opening scenario. So while the details are limited, we do have evidence that Amazon has identified a potential sweet spot in terms of product selection that many other defunct grocery chains have actually tried out in recent years, basically having a smaller footprint, so less sales floor space, for instance, and to try to create a natural selection, an organic selection, and a conventional selection. But from what we could tell, they are going to be more focused on price, which, by the way, has obviously been the main bad point, the main negative point for Whole Foods in recent years. People saying that one cart of grocery items is extremely expensive compared to one cart at a Walmart. So they're trying to eye in on that niche. And I think what they are trying to do also, again, reportedly, because Amazon won't go into comment here, is to have a model be a little bit larger than Amazon Go stores, but is still more conventional in nature in terms of the checkout scenario, like Whole Foods. However, it is noted that some people are saying that they are going to be adopting some of that Amazon Go technology, which is very prevalent in those stores in Washington State. You could see wires throughout the ceiling there, trying to carry all of that data as it tracks your shopping cart throughout the store. But as it pertains to product selection, that is the main point here. They're going to be more differentiated. They're going to stray away potentially from all natural and organic selections. It's going to be commodity-based items. So while the stores may be a little bit larger than those Amazon Go stores, which are akin to convenience stores, they're still going to utilize a little bit more square footage to house more SKUs. The Wall Street Journal reported that Amazon will look to leverage data and insight from the current stores. So think of Amazon Go, think of Whole Foods, and again, perhaps use some of the new technology within all of these banners to help out this concept. And they want to open dozens of locations pretty soon, over the next year or two, in the US, and we'll start in LA. This is in stark contrast to what we covered not that long ago when we talked about plans late last year that came out about plans to open over 3,000 stores in the United States in different areas and even smaller cities. And a lot of executives were talking about these plans for some time, but it's interesting now because a lot of media are taking this to mean that this is pretty much the start of those plans. However, when we reported on it, or at least when we discussed it on the podcast late last year, those 3,000 stores, that plan was reported as a pretty fast plan to be able to broaden out their concept throughout these metropolitan areas in a quick fashion. It just hasn't happened. So I think it is going to be a rather slow adoption. I think they are going to be, to the point we made in an earlier podcast, an adoption in larger, more densely packed areas such as LA. And you will look to see if this concept works. I think they're going to take a wait and see approach and not go in all in like some of the defunct competitors that tried similar concepts that maybe opened 100, 200 stores fairly quickly without really eyeing the data and knowing what they're getting into. But as it pertains to the short term, they're looking again at LA, San Francisco, Seattle, Chicago, Washington, D.C., and Philadelphia. And I think it's an interesting list because it's geographically diverse, but it also focuses on shopping centers. Shopping centers being, of course, an area where they can go in to maybe a defunct dollar store or something of the sort that maybe didn't carry as much sales floor space as a larger grocery store that may have gone out of business. Think of a Safeway, think of an older Albertsons location. So these types of things are going to be interesting for both the real estate industry and the grocery industry. And by the way, grocery stocks getting hit this week on this news.
Yeah, they were just as any time with Amazon and grocery being mentioned, those grocery stocks are going to take a bit of a hit. Remember that Kroger a few years ago lost about 33% of its market share when it was announced that Amazon was looking into buying Whole Foods. Of course, that a bit of an overreaction considering, again, the relative market share of those two companies. But the other big piece of news this week, without a whole lot of detail backing it up, is about Gap considering splitting off the more profitable Old Navy. Well, Old Navy has had its issues over the last decade, and we think back to 2016 when they were really, really struggling against both Gap and Banana Republic when you took comps into consideration. The discount apparel retailer has found, once again, a popular line between discounted clothing and on-trend styles. Now, Old Navy's been around since 1994 and grew to $1 billion in sales within just 4 years. Now the retailer does about $8 billion in sales per year. And again, that's just the Old Navy division of Gap. Management is separating the two for various reasons. Reasons that shareholders appeared to agree with as shares grew double digits for the company. According to executives, the move does not mean they will abandon efforts with Gap and Banana Republic, but what it does mean is they'll be able to focus more on each banner's core competencies. When we think about Old Navy versus Gap and Banana Republic, vastly different retailers, vastly different, honestly, target markets when you're looking at the three of them, particularly when you jump from Banana Republic to Old Navy. Now, in regards to Old Navy being its own standalone entity, Oliver Chen, an analyst at Cowen, was quoted as saying customers want exceptional value when talking about customers specific to Old Navy. He said the country as a whole, though, is gravitating to retailers where price is part of their DNA. And I quote that again from Chen. Chen's not wrong. When we look at the trend of retail sales, we look at all these off-price stores, Burlington, TJX, and Ross, all being very popular. We look at Tuesday Morning and Stein Mart beginning to turn it around. Those are all retailers where, you know, price is a big point towards consumers there. And we look at other retailers that are doing very well at this current moment. You look at Dollar Tree. Dollar Tree's doing very well. Five Below. Five Below is doing very well right now. And obviously, they're expanding in leaps and bounds. So you've got all of these retailers where, as Chen says, price is part of their DNA, and it could be seen fairly that Old Navy would certainly be part of this push. And so by separating those companies out, you have the Old Navy side, which isn't, you know, off-price, but again, value conscious in the fashion space. And then you have Gap and Banana Republic, which are certainly less so. When you think about Gap and you think about Banana Republic, you don't think of these crazy blowout sales that Old Navy is known for. You don't think of getting a pair of jeans, let's say, for, you know, 15 or 20 bucks. That's not the first thing that comes to your mind when you think about Gap and Banana Republic, but it is the first thing that comes to mind, along with some annoying television commercials, when it comes to Old Navy. But what's interesting, at least so far, is that management doesn't seem to have a clear blueprint for how to move forward with operational separation, or if at least they have one, they haven't released that to shareholders yet. Also, there will be some managers staying with Gap and some that will be going with the new Old Navy. All of those are details yet to be ironed out. But one thing that's for sure is both will continue to share shopper data. They'll most likely need an agreement since they'll be two separate companies in order to do so. But ultimately, at this point, it's unclear to us what the more successful Old Navy could use from Gap. And a couple of years ago, it was Gap and Banana Republic outpacing Old Navy. Now it's back to the other way around. But again, wouldn't hurt to establish this type of relationship. The more data you have, even if you can't use some of it, typically the better it is. But again, this, like the Amazon story that Leighton was talking about, one that we'll be sure to follow up on here over the next couple of months on the podcast.
Well, we switch gears a little bit to the department store industry, where JCPenney's stock rose this week 22%. This happened on Thursday on better than expected results and better than expected projected cash flow. There was a lot to take in just now, and we'll get into the numbers here. But first, we look into the history of JCPenney, something I don't think we've done, Trent, yet to this point. But their first store opened in 1902. It reached $1 billion in annual sales at the 1951 point. So in 1951, they had $1 billion in annual sales. Fast forward to now, Trent, $3.67 billion. However, that number has been decreasing year over year for the past several years. So the company, you could say, has already passed its prime. However, JCPenney, again, operational efficiency is going to be sort of a benchmark for success going forward. And I think a lot of people are excited about those cash flow metrics, but JCPenney as a stock, ticker JCP, is still way off over the past couple of years. They've struggled mightily, and I think it's for a number of reasons, a number of very valid reasons. If you're a shareholder like myself, sadly, full disclosure, I've been in the stock since about the $4.50 price point, where I thought that was pretty much the bottom for the company. I was wrong. As of Friday, shares were trading between $1.30 and $1.20 per share. For a department store, JCPenney closings haven't really been near as great as other retailers. So if you think about Sears, you think about the Bon-Ton stores that fully liquidated, and you think about a number of other stores, think of Macy's even, that have closed stores in certain malls throughout the country that do business with JCPenney as well. You know, for their part, JCPenney have identified a fine number of underperforming stores, stores that they've said in the past, and we've talked about this, that cannot hold a store within a store concept such as Sephora. Sephora obviously taking up more and more square footage as that sort of builds out into a success story within a not so successful story in JCPenney. But as we look at the numbers from JCPenney for their recent fourth quarter report, adjusted earnings per share hit 18 cents, down 68% for the same period last year. You would think that would be horrible for them, and it is not a good sign for the company, but it is still a little bit profitable on the adjusted mark, and it is 7 cents better than what Wall Street was expecting. So if you look at expectations and the overall picture, the overall scheme of what people were really thinking was going to come in from the holiday sales season, not too terribly bad. So it kind of makes sense that the stock would go up. This despite gross margin decreasing, by the way. So while earnings per share were down year over year, the margin shrank. Guess why? Continuation of markdowns for merchandise that is slowly selling. A lot of the issues that they had previously under Marvin Ellison continue to burden the company. And we're talking about finding the right product selection at the right price point. People, they'll buy the merchandise. Sure, they'll buy the merchandise, but a lot of the time, they'll buy the merchandise for below what JCPenney paid for the merchandise. And that's never a good sign. That's never a good sign when you're looking at these bottom line numbers and you have debt obligations to try to address for the long term. Switching gears to the top line revenue, That top line revenue, as I had said earlier, hit just over $3.6 billion. It's around 8.9% off from last year, Trent, just shy of the $3.78 billion that average estimates were coming in at. And I think this is tied into a little bit of what Jill Soltau talked about a few weeks ago in terms of pulling back appliances, pulling back a lot of different categories such as dining furnishings and things of that nature. I think that negative news may have hurt the company, at least in the short term, as it pertains to the fourth quarter, because that wouldn't necessarily affect the fourth quarter. I think the negative media coverage, not to really talk about what Eddie Lampert has talked about in the past, has hurt the company a little bit because their focus has been varied. It's pretty much been all over the place, and they're trying to find steady ground now. I think customers need to be aware of what their core competency is going forward, and we'll get into, I think, some of their strategy with apparel here in just a second. But I think customers are a little bit wary of JCPenney. I think it's sort of a brand problem at this point, and I think that's why sales were off versus expectations. And JCPenney, by the way, also said same-store sales fell 4%, a little bit more than what we were expecting. I was expecting 2 to 3% given their remarks previously and their guidance. But if you look at the analyst estimates, it was around a 4.3% drop-off. So I guess even though it's in negative territory as far as same-store sales are concerned, it's still a positive comparing to those Wall Street experts. But for the full year, total net sales were down 7.1%. So you can see an acceleration there if you compare the entire fiscal year versus just the fourth quarter. Not good. And comps were down 3.1% on average throughout the last four quarters. And so the divisions, I promised I would get into them. They were pretty successful in a number of categories that have hurt historically. Jewelry, women's apparel, children's apparel, and men's apparel were all said to be fairly strong, along with athletic and activewear, special sized apparel, baby apparel, and gear, and some specific outerwear were said to be hot points for the company. Lastly, before I hand it off to Trent, categories that underperformed, and this actually ties into what I just said, were appliances and furniture, as well as women's accessories and handbags. And honestly, I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that not a lot of positive media coverage has been out there about the company and their major appliances. And I think also it ties into what we were talking about when we were discussing them pulling appliances from their store, and that the selection was just not there. They don't have lower price points for their major appliances, and they don't have the selection. So their competitors, and we'll talk about one of them on this podcast in Lowe's, they are doing a much better job with these particular categories, and it's just not sustainable.
Now, let's talk about what Jill Soltau said on the earnings call. Well, a lot of what she said reflected kind of what we've seen from the company over the past couple of months. She mentioned eliminating non-core and low gross margin product categories, which, again, one of the reasons why they're doing away with the large appliances, and they want to reduce unproductive inventory. Stop me if you've heard this before. That was kind of Marvin Ellison's horn that he went back to over and over again. And speaking of inventory, we'll talk about him and Lowe's inventory coming up in the show. But Soltau also mentioned she wanted to focus on, I quote, continuing the revitalization of our women's apparel business, end quote. And so, again, you're seeing a concept that's successful like Sephora. Soltau wants to go back to that well. Not the same Sephora well, mind you, but an adjacent well. Rather than just saying, hey, we can set up stores within a stores for these other categories, saying, hey, we need to improve our brand and really get back to what Layton said and mentioned was a core competency, which is their women's apparel business. And another thing Soltau said, she wants sustainable, profitable growth. That's something she has mentioned time and again since taking over the reins of the company. It's not just profitable growth, but sustainable, profitable growth. What we saw under Ellison was, you know, they would be profitable for a quarter or two. Actually, over a given four-quarter time period, they actually were profitable over a rolling four-quarter period under Ellison, but that went away because that was kind of a flash in the pan. Soltau wants to bring profitability to Roost on a more permanent basis. And basically what you're looking at with Soltau also is tying different product categories into increased margins. And a lot of these emergent categories were maybe too competitive for the retailer to put forth so many resources when you look back. Ultimately, the recurring theme with Soltau on this call was the speed in which she feels the company should move for JCPenney to truly achieve its long-term goals. To this point, management feels like the progress they've made is extremely noticeable, although, again, you look at same-store sales going down 4%, and you say, well, how noticeable can that really be? But they have reduced inventory levels by 13% year over year. And keep in mind, too, that Ellison had mentioned constantly, hey, we're trimming inventory. Hey, we're trimming inventory. And you saw that in the balance sheet, but here you see inventory levels going down by another 13%. They want to do even better going forward in 2019, even though that may require some of that clearance action that'll erode margins in the short term. But what we've really liked to hear is the fact that Soltau has continued to have a dialogue with store personnel and management. And honestly, I think this might have been something that was missing under Ellison, because we've heard, again, from Lowe's employees and those in the know at Lowe's that that's a disconnect that Ellison has had so far in his tenure there, was this dialogue with store personnel and management. Here's Soltau noting that urgency for change starts with the ground level employee, and it's great to have someone acknowledge that. So often you get on an earnings call and these CEOs or these people that are very high up in an organization talk about initiative this and initiative that. Ultimately, how do you implement it at the ground level? Because that is what's going to affect your brand. Customers, most of them at least, aren't going to be on an earnings call getting hyped up based on what the CEO is saying. Customers are going to notice what's happening at the ground level. One of the examples I use in this case is actually out of the department store realm, but in the grocery store realm. Safeway has an initiative that's called the Three's a Crowd initiative, and it's something that the corporate level has talked about a lot, saying, hey, we're working to provide better service on the front end through our Three's a Crowd initiative, basically making sure that there's no more than three people in a line at a Safeway. Well, of the Safeways that I've been to in the past year, I've counted 16 different Safeway visits over the last 12 months. During those 16 visits, 13 times there were lines of three or greater, and no one was called to the front end to help. So again, it's about how are you implementing this at the ground level? Safeway doing a particularly bad job of it, and it reflects oftentimes in Safeway and Albertsons' earnings there. Likewise, JCPenney, you saw all of these initiatives here. Well, were they truly bringing in personnel that knew something about the appliances? Were they training personnel about the appliances? We saw the signage, we saw all of that, but were they truly applying it at the ground level? That's the question that needs to be asked, and that's something that Soltau has hammered home here, is that a culture shift has to happen at the ground level for the company to head into the right direction. And to that end, they announced a new chief merchant position with Michelle Laszlo, who most recently served as a senior vice president of merchandising over a multi-billion dollar apparel and accessories business for no less than Target Corporation. She was responsible there for all aspects of strategy and implementation of the apparel and accessories remodel program in 2018 for Target. Prior to that, she was an SVP at The Gap, who we talked about in our first story. So this is one step towards that change on the ground level. Again, a new chief merchant position, and that person, in this case, Laszlo, is going to be working with those employees at the ground level in this case to help to affect change. They also brought on a new planning executive and an asset protection senior vice president. They reported having poor shrink results lately, and they wanted to kind of shore up lost money and hurt margins with some technology investments here. Asset protection and bringing on a new SVP for that, certainly one would think that would help them out. And data leverage, finally, will also be for what management labels strong strategic decisions. Nothing new there, of course. When they were talking about data on the call, it reminds you of 100 other companies talking about data on the call. With JCPenney, though, their focus, product selection and assortment more than anything for those dastardly inventory levels and trying to get them in check.
Well, we promised we would talk about it. Now we will. Lowe's released earnings before the bell on Wednesday of this last week, which gives us a chance to discuss the progress of their new initiatives under Marvin Ellison, again, former CEO of JCPenney Company. And we look, and the immediate results, Trent, were actually favorable. Shares were up more than 2% on Wednesday during trading. They fluctuated a little bit. ended up for the trading day, and the home improvement retailer reported positive adjusted earnings per share for the quarter, beating Thomson Reuters' consensus estimates of around 79 cents, so they beat around 1 cent. Not too impressive in terms of that particular beat. For the quarter ended February 1st, Lowe's reported a net loss of $824 million. So if you look at the actual absolute amount of net income, it was negative, or around $1.03 per share, compared with net income of positive $554 million last year. And so you have to answer, why? Why is it $824 million in the black? Well, the reason being is they had $1.6 billion in pre-tax charges, one being $952 million that was tied to a goodwill impairment that we actually discussed in passing on the podcast not too long ago with their business in Canada. They've been having issues there, and we think there's a huge potential in Canada, but they just have not been operating at a high level there. And so I think there's going to be a little bit of softness in their business going forward in Canada. And they sort of alluded to that too. If you go through the earnings transcript, Canada was mentioned more times than it had been in the past as far as housing softness and overall consumer sentiment. They had revenue, the company did, overall revenue of $15.65 billion during the quarter, compared with consensus estimates of $15.75 billion. So off just a little bit in terms of what analysts were expecting there, but revenue was up 1% year over year. Soft revenue comps were again blamed on the Canadian housing market, which appears to be slowing down just like it is in the United States. However, they didn't really talk much about the U.S. housing market, unlike their counterpart Home Depot. We'll talk about that here in a little bit. But same store sales, which obviously we usually talk about right after revenue, thanks to a few less stores in their portfolio, gained at a higher 1.7% pace. So again, revenue was up 1%. Global same store sales were up 1.7%. So U.S. comps hitting 2.4%. That's always good news, but just around 40 basis points more than inflation right now. So they could do better in our view. Modest online comp growth as well at around 11% in the face of several server outages that have been reported at busier holiday shopping season times around Black Friday and around other periods. And we were scratching our head there because this is something that they have to get right. They have to get, and we can't dwell on the past certainly, but we can use historical information to know what to expect going forward. And I think that they should expect double-digit online traffic increases for 2019 or for calendar year 2019. And I think it's stupid almost of any retailer such as Lowe's or any other retailer that does a massive amount of business to not really be as prepared as humanly possible for that surge in traffic. And we all know that even Amazon has problems time to time whenever there's a particular surge in traffic, or during Amazon Prime Day, for instance, they had a few glitches last year that were reported. Yes, that's probably going to happen in perpetuity. However, for a company like Lowe's, who has far less traffic than a company like Amazon, it is truly unacceptable in our view. Lowe's had stronger spring assortment, so that's a positive. Those results helped normalize some softer categories that they talked about during the call. Some positive comps in around 8 of 11 total product categories, and these are categories that we typically always break down. We won't go into too much detail other than to say tools and hardware were very solid, and they saw a lot of positivity surrounding the Craftsman products brand. So overall, that Craftsman deal really working in their favor. I still think it's a little bit weird anytime I go into a Lowe's near me and I see Craftsman products being featured on end caps prominently. I think back to Sears and how crazy it must be for the people that had either worked at Sears or were merchandisers for Sears to see those Craftsman products in one of the largest home improvement retailers now in the U.S. But CEO Marvin Ellison says, despite the softness in Canada that I mentioned, that, and I quote, U.S. macroeconomic fundamentals should remain sound for 2019. So Trent, basically what he's saying is, despite everything that you guys are seeing in terms of analysts and investors for this latest quarterly report, the future is bright.
Yeah, and he also mentioned both on the call and later with CNBC that the consumer has a healthy balance sheet. They think that's going to parlay itself well at Lowe's. Leighton, I want to get back to the categories that you mentioned did well. I think a lot of people looked at the Craftsman as being part of it, certainly. A lot of people looked at lawn and garden appliances. But if you were on the call, and I was actually on the call when they were going through some of these categories, the most mentioned category was actually paint. And the reason was, it's not because paint is necessarily making the biggest impact on the bottom line. The reason they focused on paint so much on the earnings call is it was marked as an area that needed a lot of improvement when Marvin Ellison took over. So that's kind of been a pet project of theirs, working to get the paint section in Lowe's turned around, carry a greater amount of inventory, a greater variety of inventory to make sure they're appeasing their professional customers and those contractors, and a partnership with Sherwin-Williams. All of those things caused this big turnaround in paint, and that's really what the company was bullish in noting on the earnings call. They said, hey, we put an investment forward in paint. We especially focused on merchandising paint, leveraging inventory in paint, and it worked in terms of increased sales in that section. And that's something that they feel like they can squeeze out more margins in the paint category going forward. So I thought that part of it was interesting. But the other aspect of this earnings call that was interesting is how they broke things down. So Leighton referenced the comps there earlier in the story. Well, they broke down their comps by month and they said, hey, November, December, we struggled, for lack of a better term, just 0.3% company-wide it increased in November, just an increase of 0.8% in December. And when you look and compare it to not only other home improvement retailers, and I'm not just talking about Home Depot here, but when you look and compare that number to Ace Hardware or True Value or anyone else that's in this space, those numbers aren't good. They had a pretty poor holiday shopping season, given the increase in spend that you saw throughout the country in multiple categories, but also in home improvement. But they said what they liked most is company-wide, they saw an increase in spend by 4.8% at their stores. Same-store sales increase of 4.8% in January. And they feel like that's indicative of some of their initiatives beginning to pay off, especially in regards to merchandising and do-it-yourself and pro customers. But one of the negative parts, and that would be positive, and the paint aspect would be positive, but we have to take a balanced look here and an honest look. Their comp transactions over the same quarter a year ago were down 0.6%. Comp average ticket, however, was up 2.3%. And ticket size, when you break it down by ticket size is under $50. Those were actually down. Those transactions were down 0.3%. Where you saw the increase in transactions in ticket size, that was transactions over $500. Those increased 3.6%. You might be wondering why that is. Typically, too, you might say, well, that might be good that they don't have as many of those smaller purchases because they're driving those bigger purchases. Well, the reality of it is a lot of those increases in sales over $500 come from the Lowe's Pro Services division, which performed above the company average throughout the course of the quarter. It's not coming from the website. It's not coming necessarily from habitual consumption. It's not that they're selling that many more appliances, although that particular category was up. The reality of it is a lot of those positive sales are from Lowe's Pro Services. And in terms of the company as a whole, you think, well, that's a positive thing. And certainly that dovetails with what we're seeing with people reinvesting into their homes, using contractors coming back and using Lowe's. The only problem is Lowe's Pro Services are being outpaced by Home Depot's professional services on their end. And also one thing that I didn't necessarily like from the call in terms of a number was their sales growth digitally. Lowe's.com saw sales growth of 11%, which again is a good number. You'd rather have that than a negative number. But when you look at competitors, when you look at other players in the space, and more importantly, when you look at e-commerce as a whole, 11% just isn't going to cut it for a company that is still making these digital investments and still trying to get people in the habit of buying online and picking up in the store. So when you see these sales not really moving as much as their competitors have it moving, that gives you cause for concern. So I think it's a matter of positivity in terms of potentially having some room for improvement and seeing improvement in categories like paint where they've invested in. but also you kind of worry about their balance sheet going forward because the company has promised to invest more in tech and hiring 65,000 more people. We've seen their hiring yo-yo all over the places. They've dropped jobs over the last couple of years in batches. They've hired more people, but they want to hire more people, especially with an eye towards growing their tech. So again, how is that going to affect their balance sheet here? When they adjusted for different one-time expenditures, their operating margin grew over last year, but when you didn't adjust, it shrank 3.63%, and eventually you got to kind of account for that money that's going out for these investments. So will they be able to turn around some of the struggling categories with less expenditures than in the past? And will they be able to keep their margins the same while driving up categories like paint? Because all of the effort they put into building their paint, well, you wonder if they've got to continue putting that effort in and if that's going to continue to hit margin, or if they've bought some customers over because of that Sherwin-Williams partnership and because of the other merchandising tools that they are using overall.
Back in the U.S., the income dynamics, like Marvin Ellison had alluded to, make it such that people are expected to rehab their homes and use capital to put back into existing residences versus upgrading and buying newer homes. So we think that could potentially be in favor of Lowe's going forward, or pretty much any company in the home improvement sector. And we hate to be beating that drum every single quarter, but you do have to look at how, according to our research, there's around 10,000 baby boomers that are turning 65 every day. They're going to need stuff to do. They're going to, if they're staying in their current residences, as some studies out here in the state of California are really saying quite clearly, they are. They're staying in the residences and not downsizing, at least for the time being. Then they're going to be rehabbing their homes. They're going to be refreshing their homes. They are going to be doing certain things around the house in order to not only stay busy, but to make their homes a little bit more presentable and to utilize Lowe's and companies like Home Depot for the products that they need in order to finish those projects. But also, one last note here, multifamily development is still in process in a few hot markets out in California, out in Colorado, out in Texas. Several big developments, in fact, and I think that's going to be an area of progress for the company. And Marvin Ellison said quite clearly that their pro business, their contractor business, is growing pretty much very largely in terms of how it relates to the other parts of their business. And they're going to be having to put more resources towards that pro business to compete. And I think that's going to be a main part of their strategy going forward. Some analysts tend to agree with what we think overall, and a lot have positive sentiments too about the company in terms of what they think the economic environment is going to do for the home improvement retail sector. Like with JCPenney, Marvin Ellison really continues to visit stores and does so every single week. You can actually see his Twitter feed, which we do. And you can see that he really cares about the stores at an operational level. But with that, Trent, he does notice some things that are a little bit inconsistent when he tours these stores.
And again, it's going to come down to changing the culture. This is something that wasn't really able to do all that much at JCPenney, even though he visited the stores and put himself in and amongst those ground level employees. Specifically, management's noted some inconsistent executions in different markets. That's something we've noted, certainly. And that's something they're going to work to show up. In the meantime, customer service scores have been doing better. There is one other thing I wanted to note as it pertains to Lowe's. They have been investing in what they call job lot quantities to better meet pro customer needs. The other thing they're investing in, inventory. They think they need to bulk up in terms of inventory for particularly this coming spring season. So that might sound a little bit familiar. Remember, Ellison had inventory issues perpetually at JCPenney, so you kind of wonder if that may begin to impact Lowe's going forward. Ultimately, to summarize here, Lowe's a solid fourth quarter, certainly, one that gets them back into the conversation. They're still losing ground to Home Depot, but at least some initiatives going positively for Marvin Ellison and his new regime. Especially good to see things like paint working out, things like appliances, things like Craftsman and the Craftsman investments also working out. One thing we need to note too is that ultimately going forward, again, Lowe's shut down their Orchard Supply hardware chain out in California. They're in the midst of shrinking back some of their international initiatives. How will that affect things? And if Orchard Supply Hardware was as really as much of a money pit as we were led to believe, does that open up maybe a bit of cash flow to invest that money elsewhere in Lowe's core business? So we move on to our final full story. An up-and-coming Dallas-based retailer seeks potential explosive expansion. And I don't throw that term around lightly. You're looking from one store to potentially as many as 20 markets, which they've mentioned. And that expansion may start for the moment in New York City. Now, this story comes to us via the always spectacular Maria Halkias, who is the retail writer for the Dallas Morning News. It was reported that Neighborhood Goods, the name of the store in this case, secured a second round of venture capital funding, with some of the funds being used to open a store in New York in 2019, so later on this year. Now, there's no guarantee that the expansion will continue beyond New York City, but the company, and more importantly, management here with the company, is very bullish on possibilities over the next few years. And even more importantly, it appears as though landlords throughout the country are bullish on the retailer, as Neighborhood Goods is in the midst of a number of other potential deals that we'll discuss in a moment.
But first, we have to look into see what Neighborhood Goods is. The concept is fairly young, at least as far as their brick-and-mortar presence is concerned. They first opened their first location in the A-Class Legacy West in Plano, Texas, in November of 2018, after creating the company in the spring of 2018. And early returns are positive, and most importantly, the company leadership says they're first 4 months in the brick-and-mortar setting has attracted interest from a number of suppliers. Their current footprint is about 14,000 square feet, which includes a restaurant centerpiece. For comparison, this is roughly the size of a Dollar General or a larger Dollar General or a larger Five Below. The larger company concept has to do with bringing online-only or lifestyle brands into the brick-and-mortar space. Essentially, the entire store is a store within a store concept, or to put it another way, the most upscale antique mall or flea market that you could imagine. So you have to think pretty broadly here, but brands can lease out space for short periods of time or longer if they wish to do so to display their wares, kind of bringing a series of pop-up shops all under one roof. The idea merges the treasure hunt concept so popular in today's off-price stores because of the brands may only be there for a short period of time, and the stay and linger concept espoused by a number of A-class shopping centers is fairly popular now. And you have to look at the brands here that have shops within the present Neighborhood Goods location, include Stadium Goods, Hims, Hers, Le Specs, Draper James, and Serena, an apparel brand headed by, of course, the famous, probably the best female tennis player of all time, Serena Williams. And Serena recently ended their run to be replaced by Hook and Albert. Now, for this story, Halkias reported that Neighborhood Goods raised around $8.8 million in this latest round of funding. They raised around $14.5 million overall in seed money. And Trent, their CEO, is pretty bullish on what this funding is going to provide the company.
Yeah, Matt Alexander is their CEO and co-founder. He said the new round of funding was an opportunity basically for investors to get in on the company or get in again on the company after seeing the short-term success of their current brick-and-mortar location there in the Dallas metro area. He also mentioned the cash as kind of a way to accelerate their expansion plans, allowing them to cut into that new market in 2019, which would be, in theory, New York City. And that's kind of the hope going forward. Alexander said they do have 6 or 7 markets directly in the pipeline overall, but New York City is the fastest moving of them. He also noted that they aren't disclosing the exact location they're working on as yet, which is pretty common for real estate deals that are in this stage. But he said that there are exciting and unique, and I quote that, exciting and unique opportunities in other areas of the city that Neighborhood Goods feels are underexplored from a real estate standpoint. If unexplored here is the theme, we should probably be able to rule out most of Manhattan and a good portion of Brooklyn as well as a likely landing spot for their new store. But aside from the New York City location, perhaps the noteworthy parts of this story, or the more noteworthy parts of this story, have to do with the other markets in the pipeline for them. Now, they mentioned looking at 6 to 7 in the short-term future, but have identified 20 cities overall that they feel like meet their needs. According to Alexander, the idea behind expansion is quick but cautious, and we'd have to think that their expansion into different markets would be similar to, but slightly slower than Duluth Trading Company, who entered a handful of markets before ratcheting up and adding several new markets each year. You know, Leighton, I was just traveling throughout the Midwest trying to beat out snow or beat around snow a little bit, and I noticed a Duluth Trading Company being built in a well-to-do area in terms of retail in Wichita. So a Duluth Trading Company opening up in Wichita, Kansas, again, not the first market you think of when you think of a market for an up-and-coming business, but Duluth really has exploded now after their first 5-6 years of slowly putting brick and mortar into play. Now, the key here for Neighborhood Goods may be that interest in their business from real estate developers has been quoted as being high, and this may provide them long-term leverage in lease negotiations if they are truly as in demand as the company seems to indicate. If it's something that landlords want on their property, of course, Neighborhood Goods is going to have those leverage, that leverage in lease negotiations, maybe be able to negotiate more favorable leases, probably not in a place such as New York or San Francisco, but maybe in some other markets that are around, you know, beyond just those top two or three retail markets in the U.S. Now, overall, taking this as a whole, this appears to be a solid concept, or at least a sought-after one on the part of both customers and landlords. However, our concern is that this is a concept that would be very easy for an existing retail powerhouse, see Amazon, for example, to replicate and build out. Because really here, you're just looking at real estate and then you're looking at infrastructure for your company. Because you could get local providers of goods in every location, and because you don't have to have consistent goods across all locations, it would be fairly easy for another replicant startup to match this or an existing retailer to spin something off here. And even with the additional capital and current success for Neighborhood Goods, there is a worry they may not be able to expand both quickly and in a way that outpaces potential competition while also doing so in a sustainable way. So they're kind of in this in-between where they don't want to explode and grow by leaps and bounds and outgrow their infrastructure, but at the same time, they don't want to lose out to potentially current players in this space that could make a reach kind of into Neighborhood Goods' concept. We love the concept overall. Like I said, I think it's something that you're going to see a lot of retailers bounce into. Opening in New York City is going to be a good first step, as they'll be able to attract more key brands with the additional visibility. But again, you're looking at basically opening up a small mall of pop-up stores, and this is something that can be very easily replicated by pretty much any company that has the wherewithal to do so. So it'll be interesting to see if they can grow this out organically through themselves or they get beaten out by another competitor.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I take a look ahead to the next week, month, or year as it pertains to retail, and we'll begin with Leighton.
I'm going to be looking at the larger picture, so the macroeconomic picture, if you will, for the U.S. economy. A bunch of statistics are going to be coming out on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of this week. I picked a few of them to talk about for my Looking Ahead segment. Economists expect the Bureau of Labor Statistics to report February employment, and it's going to be supposedly around 170,000 jobs in the month of February to be an actual gain, and the unemployment rate is expected to tick down to around 3.8%. Also on Wednesday, ADP releases their national employment report for February again, and their economists forecast a gain of around 184,000 private sector jobs. This is interesting because unemployment was a little bit all over the place because of the partial government shutdown, but we're looking to stabilize here and get below that 4% level. The reason I'm really looking at these reports, or I'm going to be curious as to how the news interprets these reports, is because a lot of the hourly rates have been going up for retail workers inside the United States. And these are things that are naturally occurring through basic economic theory, aside from different legislation that has been passed on in different states, in different cities, different counties, as far as wage increases there. But right now, as it turns out, the expectation is for around a 3.2% increase year over year for hourly wages for this latest quarter. And I think it's interesting because, Trent, if you look at those year over year figures, that actually is a little bit better than we have been seeing historically, around 2 to 3% for hourly wages. And I think that bump is going to be really beneficial for things that we talked about during this podcast, such as discretionary spending in the home improvement space, such as maybe a push for more women's apparel or a different product selection inside JCPenney, where their new chief merchandiser is going to be bringing in some fresh ideas for private label branding. So I think these types of things are going to be better overall. These are still the type of figures that we expected to see over the last few months. However, again, the partial government shutdown did hurt the economy in some areas. The last thing I'm looking towards, Trent, is the Census Bureau is going to be reporting new home sales for December. Their expectations are seasonally adjusted, of course, but it's going to be projecting out a rate of around 580,000 units. This is down from around November's 657,000 units. So you're seeing that while there is sort of a slowdown trend, typically, we are seeing a larger trend of lesser home sales. We're seeing less new construction around different areas of the United States. And this really does tie in to the Lowe's story, because Lowe's and Home Depot, all the home improvement retailers, their business is pretty much predicated on not only those pro customers, those contracting customers that come in and buy units in bulk oftentimes, but we're talking about people that are no longer really interested in moving up the ladder in terms of getting a nicer, larger home. And I think that plays into the fact that a lot of millennials, as they're getting older, they still like the apartment living or townhome living, or perhaps living in a smaller home and living a minimalist lifestyle, if you will. There's sort of a movement in that area. And so I think that's going to be interesting, and to see how it plays down through the different retail economies that we pay attention to here on the podcast. The average sales price, by the way, is projected to be around $362,000 for a home. The median sales price is around $302,000. Still very expensive to live in the United States if you're building or buying new construction single family homes. You really have to think that also plays into how, because of construction prices going up, people saying, you know what, I'm going to just wait and see if there's going to be maybe downward effect in the market over the next 1 to 2 years where prices can come down. Therefore, I'll just go ahead and rent in my apartment until I see maybe a proper price point that I can pull the trigger with.
So my looking ahead story gets away from macro and actually looks at kind of the micro. And that's because Freshpet, the pet food company known for refrigerated pet food, gave out their earnings last week. Now, I wasn't really in it for the Freshpet earnings, although if you're asking, things were a little bit better than they were last year in terms of the gross profit number overall for Freshpet for the fourth quarter. But I was looking at other data because Freshpet does a great job breaking down where their sales are coming from. Because again, they're a pet food manufacturer, and so it's important for investors to know where that manufacturer is selling their goods. Of Freshpet's approximately 30% top-line revenue growth, 38.8% came from grocery stores in the pipeline, 24.8% came in mass market stores, and 19.7% came in big box pet stores. By the way, e-commerce only accounts for 1.7% of their sales. Again, partially because those products need to be refrigerated, but it was also up 89% year over year. And one thing they've been doing, just kind of as an aside, is utilizing their in-store fridge displays for fulfillment and order fulfillment to different markets. So I think that's interesting. But I want to bring you back to that top line growth number. Again, 38.8% of their growth came from grocery. Just 19.7% came from big box pet. And a couple of weeks ago, the Wall Street Journal produced an article saying that basically PetSmart and Petco, who are two privately held companies, haven't been providing the returns that the private equity firms that hold them wished they had been providing. One thing we know from the macro overall, from various data sets, it doesn't matter really who you get the data set from. We looked at data from RetailMeNot and others, suggest that pet spending in the U.S. is going up. And pretty much any retail data point you look at over the last couple of years suggests the same thing. But if PetSmart and Petco are having issues, and some of the other major pet stores are having issues, then where are the sales going? You could make an argument for some of the big box pet stores and other pet-specific stores like the Pet Supplies Plus chain, but here we see that for Freshpet, it's actually coming from the grocery category. So the reason I'm looking ahead here is, can grocers and mass market stores benefit from this sudden change in spending from the big box pet stores to the more local chains, especially when it comes to something like food? Food is a habitual purchase. This is something, especially since it's refrigerated food, that Chewy, at least not yet, can't compete with. So will more grocery store retailers kind of amp up their fresh pet offerings, knowing that people are spending more on pets? If you go to a grocery store, you're likely to see those fresh pet displays in the pet food section. Is this something that grocery stores can capitalize on? And not just pet food, can they create habitual consumption outside of this one category almost as a convenience play? So can they increase sales on toys? Can they increase sales on medications? That type of thing when it comes to pets. If they can, long term, obviously, it's going to be great for grocery stores. But in terms of the big box pet stores, they have got to do something other than just offering a grooming and medical center for pets that differentiate themselves if that shift is going to happen. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. Again, apologies for the late podcast this week. We'll be back on schedule next week, we hope, as long as weather behaves and everything like that. Once again, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast, and we'll be back with you soon.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.